I'm going to begin by reading an Eagle poem, which is like a prayer, and I'm reading this tonight for Bill Voker and his parents, Evelyn and Bob Voker, who know the Eagles. To pray, you open your whole self to sky, to earth, to sun, to moon, to one whole voice that is you, and know there is more that you can't see, can't feel, can't hear, except in moments steadily growing, and in languages that aren't always sound, but other circles of motion, like eagle that Sunday morning over Salt River, circled in blue sky, in wind, swept our hearts clean with sacred wings. We see you, see ourselves, and know that we must take the utmost care and kindness in all things. Breathe in, knowing we are made of all this, and breathe, knowing we are truly blessed, because we were born and die soon within a true circle of motion, like eagle rounding out the morning inside us. We pray that it will be done in beauty, in beauty. I'm going to read a few from She Had Some Horses and then get into some newer ones and then come back. This one poem is called White Bear. And I wrote this poem. It was shortly after Mount St. Helens was set off in Washington State. And I was on a flight to Albuquerque. I think I changed flights in Denver. And on the flight, it was late at night, and I could hear some women talking about how they had just flown over Mount St. Helens, and they were really excited because they got to see the eruption. And so I was really tired, and I had started to go to sleep on the plane, and I had this dream. It was kind of a half-dream sleep, and I saw this white bear coming down from the north. It was the image I had. And so I wrote this poem, and it wasn't until probably about 2 or 3 years after I'd written the poem that I found out actually where the white bear came from, because I don't always know where things come from in my poems. And I picked up a copy of Akwesasne Notes, which is a major international, at this point, tribal newspaper, and saw some prophecies, Creek prophecies. Now, you don't usually see Creek prophecies written down. You know, you can Hopi prophecies, yes, but rarely Creek prophecies. And they're usually kept pretty secret. But Philip Deer felt that it was time, because of such events like Mount St. Helens, that they be allowed to be written down. So in the Creek prophecies, in a very beautiful metaphorical language, he talked about the white bear coming down from the north. And then I knew where it came from. So it's white bear. She begins to board the flight to Albuquerque late night, but stops in the corrugated tunnel, a space between leaving and staying where the night sky catches. Her whole life, she has felt like a woman balancing on a wooden nickel heart, approaching herself from here to there, Tulsa or New York, with knives or cornmeal. The last flight, someone talked about how coming from Seattle, the pilot flew a circle over Mount St. Helens. She sat quiet, but had seen the eruption as the earth beginning to come apart, as in birth out of violence. She watches the yellow lights of towns below the airplane flicker, fade, and fall backwards. Somewhere she dreamed there is the white bear, moving down from the north, motioning her paws like a long Arctic night. That kind of circle and the whole world balanced in between, carved of ebony and ice. Oh, so hard, the clear black nights like her daughter's eyes, and the white bare moon, cupped like an ivory rocking cradle, tipping back, it could go either way. All darkness is open to all light. This one's called New Orleans. And this poem I wrote, it was the first time I had ever been into the Deep South. And some of my family and my Creek side comes from around Alabama, and it was the closest I'd been. So as I walked around the streets of New Orleans, I was looking for other Creeks. And I walked down to the Mississippi River and sat there for a long time listening to the boats go up and down and to, I guess trying to hook into some kind of memory because I knew it was there. And I started remembering a story about this guy named DeSoto. I don't know why I started remembering about him, but I remember being taught in elementary school about him, you know, coming to this country and looking for gold. And what I remembered was that either he was drowned in the Mississippi River or he was killed and his body was thrown in the Mississippi River. And the way I remembered it was that either the Chickasaws or the Choctaws did it. But I used my poetic license and I said the Creeks did it. Because I figured they must have had a hand in it, or at least they were thinking about it too. This is New Orleans. This is the South. I look for evidence of other creeks, for remnants of voices, or for tobacco brown bones to come wandering down Conti Street, Royal, or Decatur. Near the French Market, I see a blue horse caught frozen in stone. Brought in by the Spanish on an endless ocean voyage, he became mad and crazy. They caught him in Blue Rock, said, "Don't talk." I know it wasn't just a horse that went crazy. Nearby is a shop with ivory and knives. There are red rocks. The man behind the counter has no idea that he is inside magic stones. He should find out before they destroy him. These things have memory, you know. I have a memory. It swims deep in blood, a delta in the skin. It swims out of Oklahoma, deep the Mississippi River, carries my feet to these places, the French Quarter, stale rooms, the sun behind thick and moist clouds, and I hear boats hauling themselves up and down the river. My spirit comes here to drink. My spirit comes here to drink. Blood is the undercurrent. There are voices buried in the Mississippi mud. There are ancestors and future children buried beneath the current stirred up by pleasure boats going up and down. There are stories here made of memory. I remember DeSoto. He is buried somewhere in this river, his bones sunk. Like the golden treasure he traveled half the earth to find. Came looking for gold cities, for shining streets of beaten gold to dance on with silk ladies. He should have stayed home. Creeks knew of him for miles before he came into town, dreamed of silver blades and crosses, and knew he was one of the ones who... He was one of the ones who yearned for something his heart wasn't big enough to handle. And DeSoto thought it was gold. The Creeks lived in earth towns, not gold. Spun children, not gold. That's not what DeSoto thought he wanted to see. The Creeks knew it and drowned him in the Mississippi River so he wouldn't have to drown himself. Maybe his body is what I am looking for as evidence to know in another way that my memory is alive. But he must have got away somehow, because I have seen New Orleans, the lace and silk buildings, trolley cars on beaten silver paths, graves that rise up out of soft earth in the rain, shops that sell black mammy dolls holding white babies. And I know I have seen DeSoto having a drink on Bourbon Street, mad and crazy, dancing with a woman as gold as the river bottom. Thank you. That's old DeSoto. He gets around. I think I even saw him today. Okay, this one is called The Woman Hanging from the 13th Floor Window. And this poem came from an image that stayed with me for a long time after I went to the Chicago Indian Center a few years back, years ago. I guess it's been that long. And the Indian Center was pretty bleak. You know, there wasn't a lot of money. There was not money to buy curtains or to make it look warm. But the one touch in it that stayed with me for a long time and probably is what set off the poem in some way is the memory of a rocking chair in a room, because the chair was so round and the sun was going down and it looked pretty bleak. So for a few years after I came back, sometimes I would see that rocking chair, and soon I began to see this woman in this rocking chair. And then the poem came, and it was really strange because, well, I do a lot of revision when I write, and this poem seemed to come almost the way I revise, but not as heavily as I would have usually have to. And I kept feeling like it was one of these poems where you keep turning around and thinking someone's standing behind you, and it wasn't written at midnight, which some of them are, at 1 or 2 in the morning or even at 5, but it was in the afternoon. So it was after I wrote the poem and read it and it first appeared in print, people would come up and say, you know, I heard that story or I knew that woman, and it was always a different story. You know, it was always in a different part of the country. So she must be several. Anyway, here's the woman hanging from the 13th floor window. She is the woman hanging from the 13th floor window. Her hands are pressed white against the concrete molding of the tenement building. She hangs from the 13th floor window in East Chicago with a swirl of birds over her head. They could be a halo or a storm of glass waiting to crush her. She thinks she will be set free. The woman hanging from the 13th floor window on the east side of Chicago is not alone. She is a woman of children, of the baby, Carlos, and of Margaret, and of Jimmy, who is the oldest. She is her mother's daughter and her father's son. She is several pieces between the two husbands she has had. She is all the women of the apartment building who stand watching her, watching themselves. When she was young, she ate wild rice on scraped down plates in warm wood rooms. It was in the farther north, and she was the baby then. They rocked her. She sees Lake Michigan lapping at the shores of herself. It is a dizzy hole of water, and the rich live in tall glass houses at the edge of it. In some places, Lake Michigan speaks softly. Here, it just sputters and butts itself against the asphalt. She sees other buildings just like hers. She sees other women hanging from many-floored windows, counting their lives in the palms of their hands and in the palms of their children's hands. She is the woman hanging from the 13th floor window on the Indian side of town. Her belly is soft from her children's births. Her worn Levi's swing down below her waist, and then her feet, and then her heart. She is dangling. The woman hanging from the 13th floor hears voices. They come to her in the night when the lights have gone dim. Sometimes they are little cats mewing and scratching at the door. Sometimes they are her grandmother's voice, and sometimes they are gigantic men of light whispering to her to get up, to get up, to get up. That's when she wants to have another child to hold on to in the night, to be able to fall back into dreams. And the woman hanging from the 13th floor window hears other voices. Some of them scream out from below for her to jump. They would push her over. Others cry softly from the sidewalks, pull their children up like flowers and gather them into their arms. They would help her like themselves. But she is the woman hanging from the 13th floor window, and she knows she is hanging by her own fingers, her own skin, her own thread of indecision. She thinks of Carlos, of Margaret, of Jimmy. She thinks of her father and of her mother. She thinks of all the women she has been, of all the men. She thinks of the color of her skin and of Chicago streets and of waterfalls and pines. She thinks of moonlight nights and of cool spring storms. Her mind chatters like neon in Northside bars. She thinks of the 4 a.m. lonelinesses that have folded her up like death, discordant, without logical and beautiful conclusion. Her teeth break off at the edges. She would speak. The woman hangs from the 13th floor window, crying for the lost beauty of her own life. She sees the sun falling west over the gray plain of Chicago. She thinks she remembers listening to her own life break loose as she falls from the 13th floor window on the east side of Chicago, or as she climbs back up to claim herself again. Thank you. Well, I'd like to think she climbs back up. But when I was a kid, a story that I read, and I used to do a lot of reading that used to always bother, it would bother me for weeks, so I know the ending was pretty effective, was a story, and I don't remember who wrote it, was a short story about, called The Lady or the Tiger, in which a guy was left at the end of the story in the middle of an arena with a choice of two doors, and behind one was a beautiful woman he had wanted to marry, and behind the other was a tiger who hadn't eaten for weeks. And they left you there. They never told you. Okay, I'm going to switch into other gears and read some newer ones, and then I'll come back to a few in here and another new one. Okay, this one is a love poem, and then I'm going to read a few poems from Nicaragua. This is a bleed through. And I've been learning to play tenor saxophone, and I think this is related. It's what I'm learning about music. Bleed through. I don't believe in promises, but there you are, balancing on a tightrope of sound. You sneak into the world inside a labyrinth of flame, break the walls beneath my ribs. I yearn to sing. A certain note can spiral stars or knock the balance of the world askew. Inside your horn lives a secret woman who says she knows the power of the womb, can transform massacres into gold, her own heartache into a ruby stone. Her anger is yours, and when her teeth bite through a string of glass, you awaken, and it is not another dream, but your arms around a woman who was once a dagger between your legs. There are always ways to fall asleep, but to be alive is to forsake the fear of blood, and dreams aren't excuses anymore. You are not behind a smoking mirror, but inside a ceremony of boulders that have survived your many deaths. It is not by accident you watch the sun become your heart, then reappear in a town that magnetically attracts you. What attracts cannot naturally be separated. A black hole reversed is a white hot star. Unravels this night inside a song that is the same wailing cry as blue. There are no words, only sounds that lead us into the darkest nights, where stars burn into ice, where the dead arise again to walk in shoes of fire. Okay, this poem, I went to Nicaragua. I've been there a couple of times. And I went about 3 years ago in November. And so these poems are very different, and they were very different circumstances. The first time I went with a group of women, and we were on a fact-finding tour. So I was there for about 10 days, and we had meetings with all different kinds of people, from sometimes like 8 in the morning up through breakfast until like 12, even midnight at night, constantly, and took a lot of notes and listened to many, many stories. And one of the places we went to is a mountain town called Esteli, which they had lost an incredible number of their people to the revolution, and also to the Contras, who were then, even then, beginning to come down and torture people and kill them. And I heard, we went to Esteli, and we had a meeting in a church in which the church was packed with all people from the community, children, teenagers, old, elderly, everybody. It seemed like the whole town was there. And we had translators, and we asked questions back and forth and broke up into groups, and it was so incredibly terrible and powerful, their stories and what we heard and what they had to tell, that by the end of the evening, everybody left the church sobbing. I mean, it was just incredible. So I went back to the motel, and the story stayed with me for a long time, and what they said, and what they said over and over, is to go back and tell your people that, all we want to do is, we just want to live our lives, we want to plant our gardens, we want to sing, we don't want war, we don't want to fight, we just want to get on with our lives. But they told incredible stories, and many, many times the torturers, they said, spoke American English. The ones that were able to survive. So anyway, I wrote this poem called Resurrection after that time. Esteli, this mountain town means something like the glass of bloody stars. Your Spanish tongue will not be silent. In my volcano heart, soldiers pace, watch over what they fear. One pretty one leans against his girlfriend. They make promises, touch, plan to meet somewhere else in this war. Not far down the fevered street, a trace of calypso, laughter from a cantina. We are all in a balloon that's about to split. Candles make oblique circles in the barrio church. Line the walls with prayers. An Aboriginal woman as old as Momotombo fingers obsidian, recalls dreams, waits for the light to begin to break. I don't imagine anything. Lizards chase themselves all night over the tin roof of the motel. I rock in a barrage of fever, feel the breathing sweat of the whole town stop, pause, and begin again. I have no damned words to make violence fit neatly, like wrapped packages of meat to hold us safely. The songs here speak tenderly of honor and love. Sweet melody is the undercurrent of gunfire, yet The wounded and the dead call out in words that sting like bitter limes. Ask the women who have given away the clothes of their dead children. Ask the frozen soul of a man who was found buried in the hole left by his missing penis. They are talking, yet the night could change. We all watch for fire, for all the fallen dead to return and teach us a language so terrible it could resurrect us all. Now this one is called The Real Revolution is Love, which is also the title and the first line of the poem. And I tried to be funny in this. And I went down for, it was about 2 months ago, in January, I went down for a very short trip. It was too short, for 3 days, to read at the Dario Poetry Festival. And the first night I got in, I saw many of the poets I knew from the United States. And I was innocently drinking these things called yerba buenas. We went to this, they had a coffee house there, and it was packed with people listening to poetry. I mean, there are more dimensions to what goes on in a country. We forget, you know, we hear war, we hear Contras, we forget that there are people there living lives. People still have to get up and make bread in the morning. People still read poetry, you know, people still do these things. And so everybody was having a good time in there, you know, playing music and reading poetry. And I found out later what they were putting in these drinks. I watched, which I should have done before, but they called the yerba buenas, and they had glasses about so big, and they were putting in mint leaves and then pouring in, I saw later, about almost three shots of rum, and then sugar on top of it, you know, two or three tablespoons of sugar, and then filling it with some water. And those were what, and so I didn't know that they were that strong. Anyway, everybody, and it had something to do, I guess, with arriving there again, and you still, even though you're out of that, you still on some level know what's going on. It's still there, and it's right over your shoulder. And so I was sitting, we were all sitting probably about 3 or 4 in the morning around this table in this place we were staying, and I don't know, I just kept arguing with people about revolution. I get tired of hearing political this and political that when I know that at the root of it is love, or a sense of that somewhere at the root of what will change things is love. And I don't believe I'm just being idealistic. And so here I am arguing in the poem with Roberto throughout the poem, because he's saying, well, no, you know, this is revolution, we have to fight. And I'm trying to think, well, there's got to be other ways. And so I was trying to be funny. Of course, it turns at the end. And Diane is in here, the guilty, and Diane and Pedro were both married when they went down. I don't think, well, Diane was already getting a divorce. But I'll read the poem. She's a very good poet. She's Anishinaabe. And so is Pedro. He's a Puerto Rican American. The real revolution is love. I argue with Roberto on the slick tiled patio where houseplants as big as elms sway in a somber breeze at 4 or 5 in the Managua morning after too many yerba buenas and as many shots of golden rum. And watch Pedro follow Diane up her brown arm, over the shoulder of her cool dress, the valleys of her neck to the place inside her ear where he isn't speaking revolution. And Alonzo tosses in the rhetoric made of too much rum and the burden of being an American in a country he no longer belongs to. What we are dealing with here are ideological differences, political power, he says, to impress a woman who is gorgeously intelligent and who reminds me of the soft talc desert of my lover's cheek. She doesn't believe anything but the language of damp earth beneath a banana tree at noon, and will soon disappear in the screen of rum with a man who keeps his political secrets to himself in favor of love. I argue with Roberto and laugh across the continent to Diane, who is on the other side of the flat round table whose surface ships would fall off of if they sailed to the other side. We are Anishinaabe and Creek. We have wars of our own. Knowing this, we laugh and laugh until she disappears into the poinsettia forest with Pedro, who is still arriving from Puerto Rico. Palm trees flutter in smoldering tongues. I can look through the houses, the wind, and hear Jennifer's quick laughter become a train that has no name. Columbus doesn't leave the bow of the ship, and Alan is standing at the rim of Momotombo, looking in the world of a boy's eyes of a blue, sad rain. They will come back tomorrow. This is the land of revolution. You can do anything you want, Roberto tries to persuade me. I fight my way through the cloud of rum and laughter, through the lines of Spanish and spirits of the recently dead whose elbows rustle the palm trees. It is almost dawn, and we are still a long ways from morning, but never far enough to get away. I do what I want and take my revolution to bed with me alone and awake in a story told by my ancestors when they spoke a version of the very beginning of how so long ago we climbed the backbone of these torturous Americas. I listen to the splash of the Atlantic and the Pacific and see Columbus land once more, over and over again. This is not a foreign country, but the land of our dreams. I listen to the gunfire we cannot hear and begin this journey with the light of knowing the root of my own furious love. This poem is called Transformations. And I wrote this poem because I could feel someone's hatred coming at me. And I wanted to try to do something else with it besides retaliate with a letter or call them up and say, hey, you know, I don't like this. And I wanted to try to do something in a poem to turn that hatred into love. So that's what I tried to do in this poem. Transformations. This poem is a letter to tell you that I have smelled the hatred you have tried to find me with. You would like to destroy me. Bone splintered in the eye of one you choose to name your enemy won't make it better for you to see. It could take 1,000 years if you name it that way. But then to see, after all that time, never could anything be so clear. Memory has many forms. When I think of early winter, I think of a blackbird laughing in the frozen air, guards a piece of light. I see the whole world caught in that sound. The sun stopped for a moment because of tough belief. I don't know what that has to do with what I am trying to tell you, except that I know you can turn a poem into something else. This poem could be a bear treading the far northern tundra, smelling the air for sweet, alive meat, or a piece of seaweed stumbling in the sea, or a blackbird laughing. What I mean is that hatred can be turned into something else. If you have the right words, the right meanings, buried in that most tender place in your heart where the most precious animals live. Down the street, an ambulance has come to rescue an old man who is slowly losing his life. Not many can see that he is already becoming the backyard tree he has tended for years before he moves on. He is not sad, but compassionate for the fears moving around him. That's what I mean to tell you. On the other side of the place you live stands a dark woman. She has been trying to talk to you for years. You have called the same name in the middle of a nightmare from the center of miracles. She is beautiful. This is your hatred back. She loves you. I'm going to read three more. And I think I'll read the other new one, and then I'll end with, "She had some horses and I give you back." This poem I wrote recently for Anime Aquash, who is a young Mi'kmaq woman who was killed about 10 years ago by the FBI in South Dakota. And I wrote this poem. It's called "For Anime Aquash, Whose Spirit is Present and present here and in the dappled stars, for we remember the story and must tell it again so we may all live. Beneath a sky blurred with mist and wind, I am amazed as I watch the violet heads of crocuses erupt from the stiff earth. After dying for a season, as I have watched my own dark head appear each morning after entering the next world to come back to this one, amazed. It is the way in the natural world to understand that you are in the place the ghost dancers named after the heart-breaking destruction. Anime, everything and nothing changes. You are the shimmering young woman who found her voice when dark women are warned to be silent or have their bodies cut away from them like elegant weeds. You are the one whose spirit is present in the dappled stars. They prance and lope like colored horses who stay with us through the streets of these steely cities. And I have seen them nuzzling the frozen bodies of tattered drunks on the corner. This morning, when the last star is dimming and the buses grind toward the middle of the city, I know it is 10 years since they buried you the second time in Lakota, a language that could free you. I heard about it in Oklahoma or New Mexico, how the wind howled and pulled everything down in a righteous anger. It was the women who told me, and we understood wordlessly the ripe meaning of your murder. As I understand 10 years later, after the slow changing of the seasons that we have just begun to touch, the dazzling whirlwind of our anger, we have just begun to perceive the amazed world the ghost dancers entered crazily. Beautifully." That one was, I wrote that one about a week ago. This one's called "She Had Some Horses," and I never know how to introduce this one, so I'll just read it. "She had some horses. She had horses who were bodies of sand. She had horses who were maps drawn of blood. She had horses who were skins of ocean water. She had horses who were the blue air of sky. She had horses who were fur and teeth. She had horses who were clay and would break. She had horses who were splintered red cliff. She had some horses. She had horses with long pointed breasts. She had horses with full brown thighs. She had horses who laughed too much. She had horses who threw rocks at glass houses. She had horses who licked razor blades. She had some horses. She had horses who danced in their mother's arms. She had horses who thought they were the sun and their bodies shone and burned like stars. She had horses who waltzed nightly on the moon. She had horses who were much too shy and kept quiet in stalls of their own making. She had some horses. She had horses who liked creek stomp dance songs. She had horses who cried in their beer. She had horses who spit at male queens who made them afraid of themselves. She had horses who said they weren't afraid. She had horses who lied. She had horses who told the truth, who were stripped bare of their tongues. She had some horses. She had horses who called themselves horse. She had horses who called themselves spirit and kept their voices secret and to themselves. She had horses who had no names. She had horses who had books of names. She had some horses. She had horses who whispered in the dark, who were afraid to speak. She had horses who screamed out of fear of the silence, who carried knives to protect themselves from ghosts. She had horses who waited for destruction. She had horses who waited for resurrection. She had some horses. She had horses who got down on their knees for any savior. She had horses who thought their high price had saved them. She had horses who tried to save her and climbed in her bed at night and prayed as they raped her. She had some horses. She had some horses she loved. She had some horses she hated. These were the same horses. Thank you. This last poem is called I Give You Back. And I wrote this poem to get rid of fear once and for all. I say, fear go away, don't ever bother me again. But we'll see what happens. I give you back. I release you, my beautiful and terrible fear. I release you. You are my beloved and hated twin, but now I don't know you as myself. I release you with all the pain I would know at the death of my children. You are not my blood anymore. I give you back to the soldiers who burned down my home, beheaded my children, raped and sodomized my brothers and sisters. I give you back to those who stole the food from our plates when we were starving. I release you, fear, because you hold these scenes in front of me, and I was born with eyes that can never close. I release you, fear, so you can no longer keep me naked and frozen in the winter or smothered under blankets in the summer. I release you, I release you, I release you, I release you. I am not afraid to be angry. I am not afraid to rejoice. I am not afraid to be white. I am not afraid to be black. I am not afraid to be hungry. I am not afraid to be full. I am not afraid to be hated. I am not afraid to be loved, to be loved, to be loved, fear. Oh, you have choked me, but I gave you the leash. You have gutted me, but I gave you the knife. You have devoured me, but I laid myself across the fire. I take myself back, fear. You are not my shadow any longer. I won't hold you in my hands. You can't live in my eyes, my ears, my voice, my belly, or in my heart. But come here, fear. I am alive. and you are so afraid of dying. Thank you.